Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us. This is really an exciting occasion. We have an opportunity to hear from all five of the LA Times 2023 Book Prize nominees in the category of mystery thriller. Yay! And yeah. The only one I haven't actually met before is Tracy. So Tracy, it's really a pleasure to meet you. And fortunately, Olene Cogdill, who ace reporter, ace reviewer, general all-around mystery maven, has agreed to, instead of my usual wing it style, she's really prepared. She has actual questions, which will be, for those of you who've done these with me, which will come as a huge surprise. But anyway, it's wonderful. And this is going to stay up on our Facebook and YouTube pages. So if you know anybody that would like to have attended it and couldn't tune in right at 6 tonight, you can go watch it anytime. And authors, I'll send you the links and you should social media them so, you know, people can find them on their own. Anyway, have a wonderful time. And Olene, over to you.
Thank you very much. Hi, I'm Olene Cogdill and welcome to this panel, which is the nominees for the mystery thriller category for the LA Times Book Prize. And I just want to thank Barbara for putting this panel together. I think it's a great idea. It's a time for us all to kind of talk. The LA Times Book Prize is in its 27th year, and it's considered to be the nation's largest literary event. The Book Prize will be presented April 21st in Los Angeles, and the Book Festival will be April 22nd and 23rd. And I hope I said April 21st, not August 21st. And I believe that we are putting up a link to the Book Prize and the festival because there are still tickets left. Author S.J. Roseanne and author and critic Paula Wood and myself are the judges for the mystery thriller category. And it has been an honor and a delight to serve as a judge with S.J. and Paula. We read a lot of books, and it was very difficult to narrow it down to you five. We could have easily had 10 finalists and 20 winners. So I review mystery fiction for the Sun Sentinel in Fort Lauderdale and for Publishers Weekly and Shelf Awareness. And I've been honored with the Raven Award from the Mystery Writers of America. Our authors are Rachel Housel Hall. Rachel has novels have been nominated for the Anthony, the Lefty, the Barry, the Seamus, the Thriller Awards. She also co-wrote with James Patterson the New York Times bestseller, The Good Sister. And Rachel's novel, We Lie Here, has been nominated for the LA Times Book Prize. Laurie R. King is the best-selling author of more than 30 novels, including her very popular series about Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. She has won every award possible in the mystery genre. I'm not even going to mention them. She also was named Grand Master by the Mystery Writers of America in 2022. And she co-edited with Lee Child, How to Write a Mystery. And her novel, Back to the Garden, which launches a new series, is the one that's been nominated for the LA Times Book Prize. Tracy Lynn, who's the only author I've not met yet, she was born and raised in Southwestern Sydney, Australia. She earned her MFA at the University of Kansas. That's a long trip. And was previously a reporter for the LA Times. She lives now in Brooklyn, New York. And her debut, All That's Left Unsaid, is the book that's nominated for the LA Times Prize. Pong Shepherd. Did I pronounce that correctly? Okay, you can unmute yourself.
Sorry, yeah.
She is a graduate of the New York University's MFA program and is recipient of the 2020 Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. She's originally from Phoenix, Arizona, and has lived in many, many places around the world. Her second novel, The Cartographers, made a variety of best lists, and that's the one that's been nominated for the LA Times Book Prize. And finally, we have Alex Segura. Alex, how you doing? He's the author of 7 novels about Miami journalist turned private detective Pete Fernandez. He also has written several YA and graphic novels. And his novel, Secret Identity, has been nominated for the LA Times Book Prize. These are all winners, and I hope everyone who's watching will be buying their books. Now, we three judges, we were very struck by a lot of common themes that came up in your books. And among them was a strong sense of place that each of you had. You each gave us a look at different cultures, and you also gave us a look at families, the ones we have, the ones we choose, the ones we really don't want sometimes. So let's kind of start with setting, which I thought really influenced every one of your characters and also your plots. Rachel, let's start with you. We Lie Here revolves around screenwriter Yara Gibson. She returns to her hometown in the California desert to run her parents' 20th anniversary party. And this is a dry, dusty area, and it really affects her. She has asthma in the desert, so that's just compounding her health. Her mother constantly smokes and just won't stop. And that kind of becomes a metaphor for her, her relationship with her family.
Yeah.
I had asthma as a child, and I worried about her health throughout that novel. So let's talk about why you chose this scenery and how it informed your plot.
First, thank you for hosting this. I'm always thrilled to do anything with Poison Pen, and for you, Aline. It's great seeing everybody. Hi. Nice meeting you too, Tracy and Pong. I am a native Angeleno, so I wanted a story where it's a satellite city of Los Angeles. A lot of families back in the 80s left LA for a better life up in the high desert, which is the Mojave, which is where Palmdale is, Yara's hometown. There really aren't, people thought they were getting away from like bad things, gangs, drugs, all that. And they just simply took their kids who took all that up there with them. So they weren't getting away from with anything. So now they're in this place in this desert that has nothing to do, and bored little boys do bad little things. And then it's the desert, you know, there are dust storms, there are tarantulas and scorpions and just bad weather. And it's the worst place for someone who can't breathe. And I wanted to choose this town so far away from Los Angeles, yet so close, that threatens her life, her very physical life. And that's a place where there's dust and a mom who smokes. My sister has asthma. My husband has asthma. My dad smoked. And even when the pediatrician said, you know, you shouldn't probably smoke with an asthmatic little girl, he still did. It's an addiction, and it's kind of a selfish habit. So I was bringing all that, you know, the personal experience living in a desert town, LA is, despite, you know, we have rain now. Did y'all hear? We're out of the drought. But yeah, I wanted all that to kind of conspire to keep Yara from finding some progress, some breath, from catching her breath.
Lori, your Mary Russell novels, they take place primarily in England and Europe, but you often have used California as a setting. Back to the Garden is set near Palo Alto, but its main setting is the Gardner Estate, where a long-buried skeleton has suddenly been found. And the Gardner Estate went from being a palatial estate of one family to a hippie commune, to now it's like a favorite of tourists and visitors. Reading it, I could visualize that wisteria gazebo you talk about, and I could almost smell the blossoms in that garden. Does this garden exist? If not, what was your inspiration? And if it does exist, I want to go there the next time I'm in California. We all go.
Well, yes and no. You know, most of us wrote these books during COVID, and I, as you say, I normally send my characters off traveling the world. And I had plans to write a book that would have taken some in-person research, and I couldn't get on a plane. So I thought, well, what do I have around here? And I decided it was the time to write another contemporary. I wanted to do a contemporary, and I thought, you know, one way of doing that is a cold case, which has an element of historical and an element of contemporary. And I wanted to do it somewhere in my area that I knew well enough that I didn't have to research. However, there is a garden. There's a place called Philo It's I live in Santa Cruz, which is along the Central Coast, and it's roughly halfway between us and San Francisco. But again, it was closed. And so what I did was make use of the location and a certain amount of the background, certain elements of what is there. But I liked not being forced to use the specific garden itself, because it enabled me to do stuff with it that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise. I think anyone who goes to Filoli looking for the Wisteria gazebo is going to be surprised. And I was greatly amused that Filoli has actually asked me to come and do an event with them in the summer. So it will be great to look around and say, yeah, not so much.
Well, I really wanted to see that garden. Tracy, you need to unmute yourself, please. There you go. Forgive my ignorance, but I had no idea that Australia had a thriving Vietnamese community. All that's left unsaid takes us there. What was your inspiration for this, and how much research did you do to create this community?
Right. So I'll just provide a little bit of background for people who haven't read the book. But the story opens with the murder of a 17-year-old boy in Cabramatta, which is a Vietnamese refugee enclave in Sydney. And the story begins when his sister comes home for the funeral and learns that the police are completely stumped by his case. About a dozen witnesses were present and they all claim to have seen nothing. So she takes it upon herself to track down each witness to find out what happened and why they refused to speak. And so I'm originally from the Cabramatta area, but it's sort of a period piece, right? It's set in 1996. And so I was a child at that time. And so there was a lot I didn't know. And so I did have to do a lot of research to try to understand well, what was going on in the area at the time? Because there was a heroin epidemic taking place in the 90s in that neighborhood. And in doing the research and trying to understand who lived there, I realized that I wanted to export a different narrative about Australia, because I think Australia exports a very narrow image of itself. Most people think of Australia as like the outback or beautiful beaches with blonde surfers. And I think like that is a part of Australia, but it's not the complete picture. And in fact, in the 2020 census, about 25% of people from Sydney identified as having Asian heritage. And you know that. Again, it's from the stories that we tell and the stories we choose to export. And so so my novel kind of explores, what are the consequences of that erasure? What are the consequences when we have an idea of what is Australian, and then we exclude those who don't fit the bill? And then there was a meta layer at play as well, because in writing this novel and in wanting it to be published in the US, I wanted to contribute to exporting an additional narrative and an additional image of what it means to be Australian, what an Australian looks like, what an Australian community can be like. Mm.
Oh, I was absolutely fascinated, and I was fascinated by all your books. Alex, Secret Identity starts in Miami, which is an area you know very well, and then it moves to New York City during 1975, where your heroine, Carmen Valdez, moves. Now, 1975 was a watershed year for New York, and as you wrote, the city seemed particularly unhinged. I had myriad vacant buildings, there was rising crime. And as you said, the most beloved city in the country was disintegrating, and all they could do was watch from inside. Why New York during this time period? And I don't think you were even born during then, were you?
No, that was part of the fun of the research. once I knew I wanted to write a noir set in the comic book industry, I knew I didn't want it to be the comic book industry today. I felt like any story that kicked off the narrative had to happen in an era that we didn't recognize. I mean, comics are so prevalent now. There are Avengers movies, there's an Ant-Man TV show. So that took me back to 1975. And if you're gonna tell a comic book story, you have to tell it in New York. And I'd always dreamed of telling, you know, a New York novel. I just never felt I was ready. Even having lived in New York since 2006, it wasn't until now that I felt like, okay, I've been here enough that I can kind of cobble my way through. But what's fascinating is it's in such stark contrast to the New York of today, which has been, I don't want to say Disneyfied, but you know, you walk through Times Square, everything, you know, it's completely different from this city that's literally falling apart, you know. And then I wanted to really dive into that and show how Carmen, as someone coming from Miami, would feel completely out of sorts, even a year in. And I could really relate to that being, you know, I moved to New York in around 2006, and that first year was probably the loneliest year. Even though you're surrounded by people, you feel completely alone because you don't know your surroundings at all. So I wanted to reflect that, but also showcase a New York that doesn't exist anymore.
Well, you certainly did that. And go ahead, Alex, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
No, I was going to say thanks.
And Pung, I'm sorry, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I know I have an odd name, so I'm always trying to be sensitive about that. Yeah. The Cartographers takes your heroine, Nell Young, literally all over the map. Yeah, I know, I just did a pun. You capture the romance and the promise of places that we haven't yet discovered, and that those gas station maps that you never can get back together, they really kind of showed us. Tell us how these map places and unknown places contribute to your novel. And there's a lot of elements of fantasy also in The Cartographers.
Yeah, so I actually, the Cartographers, the novel, it's obviously a novel and there's magic in it, so it's all fiction. But it's based on a true story that I heard, I think like 10 years before I started writing. I was just in grad school and people were talking about interesting things that they had heard, you know, over the weekend or whatever. And somebody told a story about how they'd heard of a pair of map makers in the 1920s. They were in New York, and they had ended up putting a secret town. They made up this imaginary place and they placed it on this map that they were producing at the time, and they named it with a combination of their initials. They were just kind of, you know, they were marking the territory, quote unquote, as their own. And then, I don't know, a year later, they ended up finding out, because they were passing through the same area where they had planted this fake town in the middle of nowhere, that there actually was a town there. And so they stopped and they got out, and there, you know, there was a general store, there were houses, there were people living in the houses, there was a gas station, there was, I think, like an ice cream store and maybe like a boating house or something. And they were just, you know, they were baffled because they had made up this town and placed it there in the middle of nowhere. And they wandered the town for a little bit and they asked people what it was called. And the people said it was called what they had named it, which was a made up word. Yeah. So this story, I mean, you hear that and you don't, you know, it's incredible. And I started researching that story on my own. And then I started collecting maps that had that town on it, just because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be able to see that spot on the page where they had invented this place. And then it had somehow become real. And so it took a couple of years for me to realize that it wasn't just that I was really into the story. It was that it was obviously my next book, you know? But I just fell in love with that story, with that idea that maybe the map could be, you know, usually it's, you have the world and you make the map from the world, but in this case, you had the map make the world rather than the other way around, the world making the map. And that's how it came to be.
Let's talk about families and how much an important role in each of your novels families are. And Tracy, I want to go back to you. You have several layers of family in All That's Left Unsaid. There's Kai Tran's Vietnamese family with their traditional ways and their fear of white people, and they're very much rooted in their Vietnamese culture. And then you have the larger family, which is the Vietnamese community. And these two sets of families are very integral to your story. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, one of the things I really wanted to challenge with my novel was the idea that any community can be a monolith, and that we can sort of assume that a family will be a certain way because they match a certain ethnicity or racial group. And what I tried to do with my novel was to present lots of different types of families. And a lot of the time they share similar cultural backgrounds. They speak the same language. They are in Australia for the same reason. They were all former refugees. They've all witnessed the same murder. They've all chosen to not speak. And yet they do it for very different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I want to make in sort of representing this spectrum of characters and this spectrum of families is that, well, we're not all the same. And in fact, we're just like you, whoever you are. We are just as complicated as you, the reader, whoever you are. We're as capable of being funny and smart and lazy and petty and stubborn. We're just as capable of success and we're just as capable of failure. And if you can recognize yourself in that family, then how can you treat them any differently? So I really wanted to sort of showcase just how different they can be, even if society wants to paint them with the same brush.
I thought there was a lot of so much going on, which we'll get back to later. We're talking about culture. Laurie, your investigator in Back to the Garden is Inspector Raquel Lang of the San Francisco's Cold Case Unit. Now, she has a lot of insight into crime and people, but she has no social skills. You know, she just kind of wants to say, shut up. I got the feeling that she's actually looking for a family in a way, and that she was in awe of the families connected to the estate, the original family, the family that grew from the commune, and now kind of the work family that is that runs the business and the estate. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, she's an interesting character, Raquel Lang is. I am one of those writers who doesn't use an outline. I stumble my way through a first draft and then I try and decide what the book wants to be. So with this one, I found that I didn't go into her background a lot in the first draft. And I thought, well, that's something that I can decide about how much to put in the second draft. And I was fascinated that every time I started to weave in her background and details explaining who she was and how she got here, it just didn't fit. It was just like, you know, triangular holes and round pegs. And it just, she didn't want to do that. And I think part of what she is a character who is so self-contained that she's interested in people who are dependent on each other. I think that she is somewhat puzzled and yet also wistful, and not envious so much as wistful of this is something that other people have, and she's not sure that she does. I mean, she has a sister and she has a cat and she obviously has relationships, but it's not the center of her existence as it is with other people. And when you have, you know, the background of this estate that she goes to investigate the cold case, that is the body that is found there, you know, discovers that it was a commune, which is a family. Mm-hmm. I mean, a commune is nothing more than a deliberate family. And I think that exploring that is fairly central to the book and to the character herself.
I also thought the original family that owned the estate, and which there is a survivor who still lives there, was very fascinating because it really was a family that kind of disintegrated in a way.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's one of those things that you find yourself writing what you're seeing around you and as a way of working it out. So you have this, you know, this powerful male who's controlling everything, and, you know, not to go into get into politics at all, but oh my God. So you have this manipulative individual who insists that everyone has to do things his way. Mm-hmm. And when you finally have people who don't, it creates a huge rift, and the results from that just sort of shatter the generations.
Absolutely. Rachel, oh, poor Yara. Oh my God, she expects bad behavior from her family. But oh boy, it does take very long for those resentments, that vile behavior, and those tightly controlled secrets to really kind of kick in. You know, she argues with her younger sister, her father, it keeps getting moodier and moodier, and her mother, oh my God, her mother. Mm-hmm. She is just dominating. There is never a moment or an action that goes uncriticized. And Yara actually wonders if her mother even loves her. Yeah. And then the second cousin shows up out of nowhere. So let's talk about your family in We Lie Here.
Yeah, I had written, you know, these toxic things, and Mickey's family in there were the total opposite. They were very loving. They were very kind. There are secrets, but they were good intentioned. And there was love there. And I wanted to write the opposite. I mean, I know families who, yeah, they're families, but they don't like each other. And the mother is not warm and fuzzy, and the father is kind of aloof, and the sister's a mess, and there's one kind of regular person, but even she's jacked up. And I wanted to get away from, you know, the perfect Black family, because, you know, like Tracy was saying, we're all kinds of things. Moms can be of all races, pull you in and then push you away. It's all manipulation. And I found that fascinating and horrifying, because even with the best of moms, I'm a mom, and I kind of control my daughter the way I want her to. She's kind of waking up out of that. She's 19 now, but she'll never outsmart me. I just know that. But here I go, right? She'll never outsmart me. And I wanted to talk about this young woman who's coming into herself, who's seeing her mother's schemes, who's kind of admitting that I don't like her and she doesn't like me, but I'm going to try because she's my mother. I'm supposed to love my mother. And I wanted to kind of battle that, what we're supposed to, you know, we're supposed to love these people just because we're related by blood. And I don't know where we are on that. Yara, though, she doesn't know what kind of family she wants except the one that she has. And here she is in the desert, can't breathe. And she can't breathe because of the desert and because her mom and her family are just, again, taking her breath away. Mm-hmm. And I find that compelling. I mean, we all do it at holiday times where, you know, you go and you hold your breath until you can get away. You literally just keep it in until you can't anymore and you're on the freeway going home. So, yeah.
Yeah. I do wonder how, I'm an only child, so I never had that problem. But I do wonder how some people do get through Thanksgiving, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an art.
Yeah, absolutely. Pong, Nell wanted to follow in the career of her cartographer parents, but her mother died in a fire trying to save her. And she's been estranged from her father, who at the very beginning of your novel dies in a very suspicious way. And she tries to find out what happened, and she begins to understand her parents by researching them and the maps, and also the bonds that her parents' old friends had with them. Tell us about why you chose these various families, because there really are several families in your novel.
Yeah, it was really a process of discovery for me, I think. So the book is about Nell, the protagonist. She, about 7 years before the events of the novel, she's tried to follow in his footsteps. She idolizes him. He's this amazing cartographer, and she gets a job at the same institution that he does. And she thinks, this is finally going to impress him. If only I can show him, you know, I'm going to be as good of a cartographer as my mother was, maybe we can finally, you know, this will be the way that we'll get close. And instead, about a year into it, they end up having this huge argument, and it gets so heated that he fires her and ruins her reputation. And she's cast out of the institution, cast out of the industry, and loses everything that she's loved, as well as her father. And then on page, I don't know, 5 or something, he dies.
Yeah.
So But he dies, and she finds the map that they had been arguing about, the thing that he fired her over, in his desk. And so she decides, if I can figure out why he had this and why it's so important, maybe I could understand him and why he did what he did that day. And then that's really that's the heart of the novel, is her figuring out what the secret about this map is as a way to understand the man that she lost before she could. And when I started writing it, I had thought that Nell and her father, he would stay alive. They would be, you know, happy father-daughter. They'd find the map together and they would go on this, you know, quest of discovery together. And they just, like, all through the first draft, they just kept fighting and they would not cooperate. And they just wanted to keep, I don't know, breaking up or arguing or betraying each other. And I couldn't figure out why. And it wasn't until I realized it's the secret of the map is the thing that has driven them apart to begin with. And it's also, you know, the only way that you could bring them back together is by solving the secret on that map. And so that is how, I don't know, it seemed like all the secret was the thing that caused all the families, including the seven friends, who are also a sort of found family. The secret of the map is at the heart of it all. And so they all had to start very far apart, and not understanding each other's motivations, not understanding each other's secrets or why any of them did what they did. And then as you know, turn the key at the central part of it, all of it falls into place and makes sense.
I thought it was interesting too, that her parents really had friends who were family. Mm-hmm. And I think many of us don't really think of our parents as having that. I mean, I know I have friends who I feel are our closest family, but I never thought about my parents having that. So I thought that was interesting addition to your novel.
Yeah, I recently, it wasn't my parents, but it was my grandmother. My mother sent me a couple of pictures of my grandmother when she was probably even a little bit younger than I am now. And it was so amazing to see her like that, because she was so young and she was, you know, wearing different clothes, and she was with people that I had never met. I didn't know any of these people, you know. She wasn't in the U.S., she was back in Taiwan at that point. And so it was just, it really made me wonder about this whole life that she's had that I don't know that much about. And I think that was probably part of where the seven friends came from, because it was so fascinating to see those pictures and the people in those pictures.
Lily, Alex, I want to talk about the culture of comic books next, but right now I want to focus on Carmen's two families, her family back in Miami with whom she is close, and her work family, which isn't really smooth. There's a lot of sexism and racism that enters in the workplace. And I think workplace, and you came from a newspaper background too, you know, workplaces become part of a family. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, obviously, as you noted, I wasn't alive in 1975. I have worked in comics. It has been my day job for two decades, but it became a really research intensive novel. And at first, when I started Secret Identity, I thought, okay, this is going to be smooth. As we always say, when the blank page looks at us, you know, we're just going to dive in and write an easy book. But I spent a lot of time talking to women that worked in comics just in that era to get a sense of what it was like to be in this male dominated field. And, you know, Carmen arrives with her defenses up. You know, hyper-focused on achieving this dream of writing comics, and then she hits this brick wall, which is the established, entrenched industry. And I think there's a moment early on where her boss, she's the secretary to the editor-in-chief, and he basically says, I have a plan for you, it's just not this, so please stop bothering me with your book ideas. And her only friend, really, she has two friends. She has an elder editor, Rich Berger, who is kind of her guide into the history of comics, and they have this really nice rapport where they trade issues and talk about the books they love, and Harvey, who eventually becomes her collaborator, and they create this character called the Lynx. Harvey's murder is what propels her to solve the mystery, because she does it anonymously. So it was really fascinating for me to spend time not just seeing how the workplace worked back then, but also little details that I didn't even think of, you know, from my time working in comics, like what ink they used, you know, how they ferried letters, you know, pages to the letterer, like how the process continued, and the state of the industry was very poor. You know, comics was a dying form. It wasn't even considered an art form. It was like making donuts at the time. You know, people that worked in comics didn't see it as something like, oh, this is going to hopefully be a movie and then I'll be rich. It was something they did. They clocked in, they wrote scripts and they turned them in, and then they wrote their great American novel on the side. So, you know, I wanted to show the Work family in stark contrast to her Miami family. And you see it in the prologue where she basically has to hide from her alcoholic parents who are arguing, and she has to kind of find solace in comics and in the escapism. And that's in contrast to the reality she sees when she comes into comics. And the real world of comics is very gritty and grungy and not romantic at all, as opposed to kind of the four color wonderland that is the comics on the page. So it was really fascinating to spend time in that world.
Well, that leads us to kind of talk about culture. Secret Identity showed me the culture of comic books that I had actually never thought of. You showed us the power that comic books can have, showing a child another world, a different kind of storytelling, making reading exciting, and also even helping someone learn English. You showed us how someone who can feel like an outsider can feel very much a part of something by reading these comics. So let's talk about the culture that you brought into that.
Yeah, I mean, you discover that Carmen's bond with her father is very much tied to comics. You know, the journey to the newsstand, the kind of spinning the spinner rack and seeing the different colors. And she notes that her father learns how to read English from like Archie comics. And that's all stuff I experienced or friends of mine experienced. You know, Cuban American kid from Miami. I remember, you know, the Archie comics just showed me a different world, like pure Americana, like this world that I just didn't understand. And then as you get older, you start getting pulled into like superhero comics and the amazing action and artwork. And I just wanted to reflect that wonder through Carmen, like this kid that's kind of having a miserable life in terms of her parents, like in terms of her day to day. She's unhappy, but this is her one moment of serenity is going to the newsstand with her dad and kind of seeing him in his best self, and then transferring that hero mentality into the book she's reading. And that really propels her into her career, which I could relate to a lot, but I also thought, you know, she was having a very unique experience too.
I thought the scenes with her and her dad going to the comic book store was just so touching. And it just, you know, I really got into the whole idea. And I, like I said, I never thought of comic books in that way before. So,
okay.
Tracy, you really delved into the culture of that Vietnamese community, adhering to the traditional ways and then showing a new generation going a different way. You want to talk a little bit more about the culture that you showed?
Yeah, I really leaned into the culture of this Vietnamese refugee community to find ways that it could serve the mystery of the novel as well. So you have all these witnesses who aren't speaking. So why not? And so I could lean into like the superstitions of certain people. I could lean into the skepticism of the police force, the skepticism of authority. I could explore, you know, characters who had come from Vietnam and had experience with the draft, and the skepticism of the Vietnamese police sort of transferring, you know, over to the Australian police as well. And so there was like the culture of fear, the culture of, I guess, suspicion, all of that could serve the mystery of the novel. But then there's another layer, which is sort of the culture of white supremacy that exists in Australia and in America. Like there's a younger generation in this novel that was either born or raised in Australia. They feel like they have nothing to do with what happened in Vietnam, and most of the traumas they experience, the discomfort, the frustration has to do with how they are treated by white Australians. And so it's interrogating like the culture of unconscious bias, of well-intentioned people who say and do racist things and then become really defensive if they are ever called out for it. And how, again, like then these young, you know, Asian Australians feel burdened by that. They feel as though they are now responsible for not hurting someone's feelings, even if that person hurt them first. So it's sort of like the complexity of, you know, these two cultures and how they interact with each other.
I also thought it was very interesting. You just mentioned something. The police force that is patrolling this area is 100% white. and which you mentioned a couple of times in the novel, they have no idea how to relate to the Vietnamese community. And that was just, wow.
Yeah, in the 90s, Cabramatta was predominantly Asian. And at one point in time, the police force was 100% white. So that was drawn from actual, that's like a historical fact. And, you know, this community was experiencing a lot of problems. There was, you know, rising crime, there was like gang warfare, there was a heroin epidemic. And so many people, like whether it was politicians or the police force, seized on it as an example of multiculturalism failing. You know, this is why we should not be allowing refugees and immigrants into the country. There is something wrong with this community. And there was something wrong with that community, which was untreated, undiagnosed PTSD with no social support, no compassion. It's like, of course, you will have these problems when you're not treating people in a humane and dignified way. But so many people at the time, again, were just sort of, you know, using it as an opportunity to fill their own agendas. And the people who suffered the most were the people who lived in this community.
Absolutely. Rachel, you showed us the culture of a small town. Palmdale sounds like a dreadful place to live. Which is a contrast to your other novels where, you know, it's more urban.
Yeah. Again, it my grandparents, I was raised Seventh-day Adventist, and like all kind of Protestant religions that believe like in the apocalypse coming and Jesus returning, the last days, you're supposed to run to the mountains. Well, my grandparents ran to the mountains, and that was Palmdale. And back then, I was born in 70, so they moved there when like 78, 79. There were no streetlights there. They built their own house. It was pretty miserable. And then people discovered it. And so, like I said earlier, they moved out there in droves, and you know, the MIG houses went up there, and there's some aerospace out there, but there really isn't much industry out there. So people are commuting still to Los Angeles. My brother-in-law actually lives out there, and he commutes to Santa Monica, which is the beach, every day. And so here you are wanting this quality of life in the high desert in your kind of nice house that isn't worth anything, still on the road for 3 hours a day. And you're unhappy and you're grumpy and it's kind of miserable. And you know, it's the desert. So you have your very high temperatures, 120 degrees, and now you have snow. So this is a place where you just can't be comfortable. People do the best that they can. And there's some nice places there, but it's not this mecca that everyone thought it would be. And when you're unhappy and when it's a kind of a transitory town, you're going to have problems. There are Nazis out there. There are neo-Nazis out there, and there are Bloods and Crips out there. All the bad things, again, that you were trying to get away from in Los Angeles are multiplied because there's nothing to do except, you know, look and be in your car and go to Applebee's. And what kind of life is that? And Yara, she got away from that. She landed a great, you know, TV writing job, and she's living this life in Los Angeles, but her families back there, and as much as she tries not to go there, she has to, because we all have to go home one day, right?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Pong,
it's a sexy kind of like, come here and get a 7-room house for only $3, but then you're like, what do I do now? This is awful.
Yeah. And Pong, I think you take us to the culture of Americana and the road. And to me, I was just fascinated because I remember those gas station maps, and you can never fold them back together. It's just.
I did that. And then also, the thing that I found the most intimidating was the culture of cartography, because it's like, on the one hand, it is an art, but on the other hand, there's a very big scientific component to it and a mathematical component. And that's definitely not my thing. I'm not very good at either of those things. And so it just felt, and I was also writing it during the pandemic. And so I'd had a lot of ideas about places that I could go and, you know, people I could talk to, and I was going to go, visit the offices of cartographers and see how they worked. And then, you know, everything shut down. And so I was trying to do all this research just, you know, online or on with phone calls, looking at photos. And I was, there's some disciplines that just feel more closed than others. And I actually think for a lot of people who aren't in the publishing industry, who aren't writers, publishing feels that way. It's like very insular and very secretive and mysterious. And to me, cartography felt that way too. And so that, I think that was even more intimidating than trying to capture kind of the feeling of like old Americana, was trying to make sure that my cartographers were believable cartographers.
I have a couple more questions before we break for questions from the audience. And I do hope whoever's watching will come to the LA Times Book Prize to see which one of these wonderful authors takes home the prize. Frankly, they are all winners and these are all wonderful books. So what's next for each of you? Lori?
Oh, I've just finished the first draft of number 18 in the Murray Russell Sherlock Holmes series. It too has a historical element, which I was amused to find. I seem to be working on these multi-layer stories. It's called The Lantern's Dance, and it'll be out in February next year.
Okay, wonderful. Alex, what are you working on?
My next novel is a YA Spider-Verse novel called Aranya Spider-Man 2099, Dark Tomorrow, and it features the two Latinx spider heroes traveling through time. But my next crime novel is Alter Ego, and it's set in the same world, The Secret Identity. It's in the modern day with a new protagonist, and it's not a sequel. I hate to call it a sequel, but I also hate the term spiritual sequel. So it's the other side of the coin. It's a new protagonist that is hired to spearhead the relaunch of this obscure 1970s character called the Legendary Lynx. And as she starts the process, she realizes there's much more to it than she thought. And unearthing that mystery pulls her into kind of the darkest corners of the comic book industry.
Cool. Tracy?
I'm working on another novel. I'm still figuring out what it is at the moment, but it probably will open with a mystery as well, because it's such a fun genre to write in.
Okay. And fun to read and fun to review. Pong?
I actually just turned in my third book to my editor, I think a week ago. I haven't had to pitch it yet. This is kind of scary. I would describe it as a sci-fi thriller. And it's about this kind of futuristic, mysterious reality TV show that lets contestants go backward, like rewind their lives and make different decisions to see how their paths would have changed. Oh. And so well, maybe I shouldn't give away the twist. Never mind. I won't tell you the big surprise.
Yeah, no plot twist there.
Yes.
And Rachel, are you going to continue on the standalones, or are you going back to a series?
Yes, for the moment. I'm loving Standalone Land for the moment. My next story comes out in the summer. Once again, it's a story that's filled with place and family, and it's called What Never Happened. And it's a story of a obituary writer who returns to the house her family was supposed to live in on Catalina Island, which is off the coast of California, off near 21 miles west of Los Angeles. And Catalina Island is like basically this kind of getaway. William Wrigley, as in Chicago, William Wrigley chewing gum, he owned that island. And there are buffalo there, and it's very touristy. They're running out of land. Every house is now like Airbnb. And there are some race issues in real life. There are probably 1.25 Black people living on Catalina Island full time. And that's a problem. And so my obituary writer goes back to this house that her family owns. Her aunt's still living there. And she wants her house back. And she works there for a moment at the newspaper, and she gets her own obituary sent to her in the mail, basically threatening her and telling her she needs to leave. So it's about family, about secrets, about how the place influences how you act. Mm-hmm. And it's a, basically kind of a closed room mystery, but on an island. And it takes place right at the beginning of COVID.
Okay. That makes things Patrick, hard. Patrick, if you are there any questions from our viewers?
Hey, everybody. Yeah, there are some questions. Actually, Alex is getting a lot of the questions here today. let's see. Fred would like to know, Alex, are you a graphic novel reader collector? If so, who do you read and collect?
Yes, I grew up reading comics. I'm an avid, I still read comics. I'm a Wednesday comic shop person. Every week I'll pick up my comics and you know, I read superhero stuff. I read indie press publishing. You know, I'm all over the place. My one favorite comic book ever has to be Love and Rockets, which is this 40-year dual saga by two Chicano brothers, Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez. One, and they're both in fictional areas. One is Palomar, which is a fictional Latin American country, and another is Hoppers, which is kind of a part of LA. But the art is, I call it punk rock Archie, because the art is very clean and welcoming. And then you read the book and it's this like punk rock kind of gutter adventure, which is fascinating to me. And just the characters evolve and age with time. So it's really, if I recommend one comic to anyone, it's Love and Rockets.
And isn't that interesting that Love and Rockets, you know, the band, are reforming to play at the Cool World Festival this year.
Well, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think Bauhaus was last year. Pretty interesting. Let's see. Okay. And also, Fred would like to know, did you ever get a chance to meet Stan Lee?
I did. I have a very, I went to interview Stan when I was working at this magazine called Wizard, which means nothing now, but at the time was like the Entertainment Weekly of comics. You know, they had all the exclusives. It was a print magazine. Like, you'd run to the store to get it so you could learn what was happening in X-Men or whatever. And I went to his Beverly Hills office and I got to sit back and listen to him tell stories, like, you know, when he came up with the Fantastic Four with Jack Kirby and things like that. So it was pretty fascinating. I would never claim that I knew Stan well, but it was really cool to just sit there and listen to him.
Right on. Let's see. Oh, this is a very nice comment for our host today. Is it Olin or Olin?
I want to. It's Olin, like Colleen without a C.
Got it. I've seen the name forever. I just didn't know how to pronounce it.
Okay. No one else.
Olin. Got it. All right. Miriam says, it's so nice to see and hear Aline Cogdill after reading her articles in the magazine for so long.
How lovely. Thank you.
Thank you, Aline.
And to such a nice, organized bunch of questions. It's great.
Oh, thank you.
And having a night off is great, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see here. Who are some of the novelists or writers that have inspired all of you? You know, if you had to kind of mention a few, you know, within the genre and with, you know, outside of the genre, maybe.
That's a great question.
I would say for me, the first novel that comes to mind is Dennis Lehane's Shutter Island. It is so freaking twisty, but good. And one day I want to write a story like that. And I return to that as like my North Star. It's like, that's, I'll know I've made it when I can do that thing right there. Like many of us, we read each other's stuff looking for tricks. You know, I am envious of so many of the tricks you all play. And it's awesome to have a wealth of books that we can all turn to.
Who doesn't love a good asylum novel too?
Right? Right?
Yeah. But marriage novel too.
Yeah.
You know, right?
Yes, true.
Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of the golden age people, I think all of us work our way through, you know, Josephine Tay and Dorothy Sayers and Marjorie Allingham. And I have to say that I always have had returned to Tay, because she has the most amazing way of flipping a story on its head. And you read one and you think you're starting off with this sort of normal detective story, and it's the 30s, right? And so she's writing these things and they're detective stories and they're crime. And then all of a sudden it's the whole story is upside down, and what you thought you were dealing with isn't there. And I just am fascinated with how people do that so organically and so naturally. As you can feel her chuckling to herself, thinking, I have it.
That's a great question. I'd love to hear from Alex and Tracy and Pong.
Go ahead, sorry.
I love your plants, by the way. I just want to say that your plants are just amazing.
Special thanks to my wife. I have no idea what they are.
I would recommend, there's a book called Interior Chinatown, and it's by Charles Yu, and it's about this young Chinese guy, and he wants to be a movie star, or like be a TV star, but the only roles that he keeps getting are just generic Asian guy. And it's of course a metaphor, like for his whole life, not just him in the movies, but the whole book. I love structure stuff. And so the whole book is written like a movie script, as if he's the actor playing generic Asian guy in the movie that is his life, that is the world. It's so cool. It's really cool. And it's a very serious book, but it's also a lot of fun to read for that reason.
I think for me, shocking, probably absolutely no one, is Michael Chabon's Cavalier and Clay. There wouldn't be Secret Identity without Cavalier and Clay, because I remember reading it in college and loving it, of course, but also wondering, like, I really want to see the comics that are being talked about in the book. And so that's kind of what spurred I hope I get to the right page, but Secret Identity actually has comic book art in it from the story Carmen writes. So you see like sequences in graphic novel form. And my kind of mantra throughout the book was like, what if Megan Abbott or Patricia Highsmith wrote a comic book noir? And so that was really like my guide, you know, to have that suspense without the excessive body count, but really lean into mood. And Patricia Highsmith actually wrote comics.
She did.
Which was an interesting little fact that I stumbled on while researching the book. But yeah, those were kind of my guiding lights.
And I really love anything that Viet Tan Nguyen does. And he has this fantastic quote that goes something to the effect of, a lot of novels that are politically or historically concerned tend to be long on mood and short on entertainment. And why can't a novel do it all? And right. So The Sympathizer, for example, tackles issues of colonialism and American imperialism, and it's a spy novel. And once you sort of realize the ways in which authors sort of borrow from various genres to make their work more engaging and compelling, you start to see it everywhere. So like Angie Kim's Miracle Creek is about sort of motherhood and disability, and it's also a legal thriller. Julia Phillips' Disappearing Earth is about violence against women, and yet it opens with a kidnapping. So you start to see these tricks that people use that just really hook a reader. And so yeah, I think any author that does that kind of thing, I definitely draw a lot of inspiration from them.
Let's see here. Let's ask you a question, Olene. What are some of the books, you know, aside from our distinguished panel today, that you've really liked that might be coming up that you want to alert readers to?
Oh boy, it's like so many books in so little time, and I completely forget about them.
So many good ones right now too.
Yeah, Laura Lippman has a good one coming up called Prom Mom. And I read 10 to 15 books a month. So once I've written the review, I kind of forget about it for a while. So I really can't even answer that. But anyone who, I always post my reviews on Facebook, and people can read that and see what I like and what I don't like. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I mean, it's so great seeing the genre, you know, like a new generation coming up and people, you know, expanding what can be done in the genre, which is
really I hate the term transcends the genre. I hate that term. The genre is just fine where it's at, but we are expanding it. We are going to another level. And I love the genre and what it can do and the stories it can tell.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I just did a program with this young writer, Eli Craner.
Oh, I love Eli.
Oh, yeah.
Has a book out called Ozark Dog.
It's so good. Yeah.
So good. So good.
Yeah.
And Dennis Lehane has a novel coming out at the end of this month.
That's right. Yeah.
Dennis, Dave Barry.
Very personal, I think, for him in the 70s, Boston.
Yeah.
Ivy Pacoda's new book is killer.
Yeah. That's the one I was trying to think of.
Yeah, it starts out here in Arizona. Anyway, there's so much going on. Let me see here. What else do we have? Robin, our friend who tunes into a lot of our events. Robin, good to see you. Thanks, Aline, for sharing and honoring this interesting group. I feel my book budget will be blown this month.
Good.
The only one she has is Lurks Back to the Garden so far. So
get it.
Let's see. Let me just switch over to Facebook real quick. And
whereas I have to say, I was amused at this list because I have of the four people that it's not me, I had three of the books. I'm not going to tell you which one I didn't have, but I thought, must be a good list because I've got three people here. Check.
I felt the same.
Here's a good question, maybe to kind of end on. It's from Christina, friend here in Arizona. She says, Aline, how do you read so many books a month? Do you use audiobooks?
I don't use audiobooks. I used to listen to them when I actually committed to a job, but I work from home now. But I consider this my job. So I set aside certain hours during the day to read. I read at night when I go to bed. My husband's a theater critic, so when we're going to a play, which can be anywhere from 30 miles away to an hour and a half, he drives, I read. Coming back, I drive and he writes. It works out fine. I think of it as my job. And instead of doing something for 8 hours, I am reading for 4 hours a day or whatever. So.
Wow. Thank you for doing that. You've been.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Advocate for all of us.
I loved checking out your reviews, Aline. It keeps me in touch with the mystery world.
Oh, thank you. And thank you all for writing such good books. And it's funny, Lori and I have done at least four panels together in the past couple years.
Yeah. We seem to be overlapping a lot.
Yeah.
Well, we sure appreciate you agreeing to host this panel tonight.
And my pleasure.
I'd like to thank all the authors. Always great to see you all. Hope to have some of you here in the desert in person at some point in the future.
And we'll see you all in 2 weeks.
2 weeks, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, see you soon.
Yes, see you soon. Thank you all. Thanks, Patrick. Aline.
Have a great night.
Thanks, Patrick. Good to see everybody.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.